We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series Toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have another escapee from the chess world rejoining us today. It is my great honor to have the two-time U.S. champion. He's been a top 70 player in the world in the early 1990s. He was also the two-time U.S. junior champion. Since then, he's been working in the finance world primarily. He worked at another chess player, Peter Thiel's hedge fund for a while. He ran his own hedge fund called appropriately Grandmaster Capital. Back in his active chess days, he was a member of the world champion, preparation team for Grandmaster Viswanathan Anand when they played Kasparov in 1995. He wrote a book about that called Kasparov versus Anand, the Inside Story of the 1995 World Chess Championship Match. He's also the author of a very popular Complete Idiot's Guide to Chess and its successor, Learn to Play Chess Like a Boss. So still tons to talk about chess-wise as well as otherwise, and I am excited to bring him in. So Grandmaster Patrick Wolf, welcome to the show, and how are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much, Ben. It's an honor to be on your podcast.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you. As regular listeners may have heard me mention, I love hearing the stories. I don't know if it would be offensive to call you an old timer, but certainly someone who's been around enough to accumulate some great stories and have some wisdom and some perspective on what you achieved in chess and now what you're achieving away from chess. Yeah. But of course, I want to dive right into chess. So I've been reading your book, which recent guest of the show and longtime friend of the show, Christopher Chabris, was one of the publishers, along with yourself and Timothy Hanke. H3 Publications came out with this Anand book, which I finally got around to reading now that I'm interviewing you. And of course, you've got your other chess books as well, in addition to your playing career. So my first question, Patrick, is just how often you think about chess now that you're not competitive every day?
I basically think about it all the time. I mean, you know, it's kind of white noise in my head. So I'm pretty sure not a day has gone by that I haven't at some point had a chess position in my head, literally just as sort of white noise. And then I still follow chess. You know, one of my favorite things to do is I'll go on chess.com or chess24, follow one of the tournaments. You know, we have the Legends of Chess now that's going on, and I like to follow those games. I'll go to chessgames.com and play over some old time games, as well as play over some recently played games. And I also like to play over the computer chess games. And it actually surprises me that more chess fans don't seem to spend more time on the computer games, because basically the gods are among us now. And
right.
The games that these computers play sometimes, I mean, the interesting ones, are extraordinary. So I think about chess all the time. I'm still a fan, and I'm sure I will be for the rest of my life.
Glad to hear it. And of course, you've been rumored to play some internet blitz over the years. Is that something you're still active in?
So, yeah, you know, the problem for me for playing online blitz is it's basically like giving a crack addict just unlimited supply. So I first had this problem in 1999 at the Internet Chess Club, back when that was the place where everyone played. And, you know, I had graduated from college finally. I was working, you know, my first full-time job as a management consultant. I was working sometimes 60, 70, even 80 or 90 hour weeks at times. It was, you know, very intense. And, you know, from time to time at my desk, and late at night, like, I just lose an hour or two playing chess. And eventually I just had to take it off my machine. And from time to time, I'll wander back in and I'll play, and I'll play sort of semi-obsessively for a period of time, and then I'll just take it off my machine again and stop. And the problem for me now as well, of course, is I'm just not as good as I used to be. And it's kind of painful, because I know I have some idea of how I used to be able to play chess, particularly sort of in my best years. And I'm sure I'm at least 200 ELO points weaker than I used to be. Not just because my openings suck, but also because I'm just not as sharp, anywhere near as sharp tactically and so forth. And so I love the game, but it's painful for me to play when I know I'm just not playing at the same level I used to be able to. And in order for me to get back to that level, well, I'm sure I couldn't get all the way back, because at 52, you know, and by the way, I heard your interview with Chris Chabry, who's a dear friend and a great guy and super smart. And, you know, the whole sort of fluid versus crystallized intelligence, without his knowledge of cognitive psychology, I've had a similar type of theory about chess for a long time. And I know at the age of 52, like, I've lost a fair amount of fluid intelligence, and probably my crystallized intelligence isn't as good as it used to be either. So, okay, I probably couldn't get back to that level. But in order to get back to some sort of fighting shape, I'm sure it would take several months of just completely focused effort. And since I wouldn't be able to get back to the same level anyway, and since I've got lots of other things I want to do, I'm never going to do it. So I think at this point, I'm mainly a fan. But
you've summed up the aging chess player's dilemma so well there. I mean, most of us are coming at it from a lower level than you. But yeah, it's quite the conundrum. I mean, you know, you can still work on chess just for enjoyment. But I mean, I think especially having been as strong as you were and achieved as much as you did, it's I can understand why you've thought it through and just realized it's not meant to be.
Not meant to be. It's amazing to me, by the way, that Anand has managed to stay at the level. And I think finally in the last couple of years, we've really seen sort of the decay, right? And he reminds me at this point a little bit of Karpov, sort of 27, 28 years ago, I think, when he was sort of beginning his decay. But I mean, Vichy, really, I mean, his second world championship match against Carlsen, he came within a hair's breadth of actually making it an even match. I mean, it's very impressive how Vichy's kept it going. I don't know how he does it, but of course, I've spent my whole life not knowing how Vichy does what he does. So why should this be any different?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. We kind of always you know, there's a lot of folklore associated with Fishy being sort of a singular genius, but I wouldn't automatically assume that means he's going to age differently than everyone else. But whatever it is he's doing seems to, I mean, even as you say, maybe he slowed down a little bit, but still, if you control for age, he's as strong as anyone.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's very, very hard in your late 40s to, I mean, you know, Viktor Korchnoi was some sort of freak of nature, right? And sort of leaving him out, I just don't know anybody who was able to sort of, you know, Vasily Smyslov, I remember, had like a really amazing sort of golden period late in his life. But even that wasn't at the same level. And Vishy, I think, basically kept at the, I don't know exactly, but until the age of maybe 47, 48, he was probably about as good as he had been in his, at his prime. It was pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary. And reading your account of your time with Vishy, I mean, it was just fascinating. So for listeners, one thing I'd like to add is, so this book, Kasparov vs. Anand, the inside story of the 1995 World Championship match, I hadn't read it previously, not really by design, just one of those chess books that kind of slipped through the cracks. So, but Christopher Chabry, who Patrick just mentioned and listeners probably know, he actually has the PDF posted online. So without guilt, listeners can go download it and read it. And I definitely encourage you guys to. There's some great living history in there. But in the meantime, Patrick, could you talk a little bit, like walk us through your relationship with Vishy? I know that you guys had your first encounter in your teens.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so I first met Vishy at the World Junior Championship in Finland in 1984. So I'm pretty sure that's right, because I won the U.S. Junior Championship in 1984.
And that's what your book said, so.
Yeah, so I think it was later that year. Well, that I remember, but I think it was later that year I went to the World Junior Championship and did all right, nothing special, and met this young Indian kid who at the time was himself nothing special in terms of his ability, but was just obviously incredibly talented. And I actually won. I think that's my one and only tournament game victory against Anand. It was kind of a nice game, but. And I remember the postmortem because he was just blitzing out variations. And I think he played the entire game in 15 minutes or something like that. But that was the first time we met. We then we met again at another World Junior Championship. And it's possible we met some other time between there. But I remember the World Junior Championship in Baguio City in the Philippines. And that was 1987. Again, I won the U.S. Junior Championship that year, went and played. That was the year that Vishy won, and I tied for third that year. I think I got fourth on tie breaks behind Serper, if I remember correctly. I played Vishy again that year. That was a draw. It was also a pretty good game. But of course, by that time, Vishy was already, it was clear that Vishy was someone special, right? And he just had a great tournament. And it was a very strong, I mean, Ivanchuk was there, Gelfand was there. I mean, it was like a super strong tournament. And we became friends and we were friendly and, you know, we would see each other every once in a while at chess tournaments and so forth. But the relationship really intensified in 1992. It was the spring of 1992. And I got one morning, I got a phone call completely out of the blue from Vishy. And at that time, of course, Anand, I mean, I don't know, he was probably top six or seven in the world or something like that, right? And he called me up and asked me if I wanted to be an analytic, basically a second. So his analytic partner, and then accompany him for a match that he was playing against Ivanchuk in Spain. So I traveled out to Spain. I spent a month analyzing together with Vishy, preparing openings and so forth. And then I spent a couple of weeks with him I'm totally blanking the name of the city. It's like that famous, begins with an L, that famous city. Anyway, the one with
Linares?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
I can't believe I blanked on Linares. But anyway, so spent time there and was his partner. And I wrote about it. I wrote a long article about this in the American Chess Journal, which was this chess journal that Chris Chabrie, Tim Henke, and I, mainly Chris Chabrie and Tim, but I worked with them. They started, and it published, I think, 4 issues. I'm actually pretty proud of that article. I thought it was a pretty good article I wrote about it. It was an amazing experience I had working with Anand. And I went there thinking, okay, Anand is obviously really good and I'm gonna learn a lot, but is he really that good? And after a month, I mean, really probably after the first week, but after a month of working with him, it was like being in the presence of God every single day. By the way, God, but God incarnate, like, you know, just in a perfectly nice person, you know,
right?
Not like some sort of crazy ego or something like that. But just to be across the chessboard and analyze with him every day, it was so humbling because he just thinks faster and sees more all the time. First of all, it was a deep experience for me because first of all, I learned from that experience. It was 1992. I'd been professional for a couple of years. I was pretty good. I still had ambitions to try to get, like, you know, play for a number of years. But after working with Vichy, I just saw, like, okay, maybe I could get to sort of the top 30 or 40 in the world. That seemed perfectly realistic. Maybe I'd have some good year where I could break into the top 25 if I got lucky. But no way was I going to get into the top 10. And no way was I going to get to Vichy's level. Like, it just wasn't humanly possible. Like, I just saw, okay, this isn't going to happen. So it forced me to reevaluate what I want to do with myself. Secondly, it turns out that working with God for over a month is really good for your chess.
Right.
So after working with Vichy, like I won the U.S. Championship later that year. And in fact, after I worked with Vichy for the World Championship in 1995, I won the U.S. Championship. If only I could have worked with Vichy every
right.
Maybe I would have won the U.S. Championship. But it was pretty amazing, right? Like you just learned. I just learned so much. Not just in terms of openings or stuff, but in terms of having a more creative perspective, being sharper, turning ideas more quickly. It was quite an experience.
Yeah, and by the way, I read the article that you mentioned about the Anand Ivanchuk, and that's another one that Christopher Chabrie has graciously posted online. So listeners, I'll direct you to both the book and the article. But I mean, this idea of these two young hotshots, Anand and Ivanchuk, playing in this exhibition match, I checked, as you say, both were in the top 10 in the world at the time. And Ivanchuk, I think, was actually a couple notches higher. That must have been in itself, like, quite fascinating. I mean, obviously, okay, you have a professional and a rooting interest working with Anand, but just as a spectator, yeah. I love the idea of seeing a match like that.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing on so many levels. I mean, I told you about what it was like to work with Vichy, but also the depth of the opening preparation was really impressive. And it was very effective opening preparation. We used a lot of the ideas, well, I should say Vichy used a lot of the ideas in his match against Ivanchuk. It was also very interesting to see the psychological aspect of it. I think that match was important for Vichy in terms of his growth. And I tell the story in the article, but I'll tell you the story briefly. The match was not for anything, right? It wasn't a qualifying match for anything. It was just an 8-game match, sponsored by this guy, Rentrero, the chess lover, right? So they were paid for it and so forth. So Vichy was leading 4-2, 8-game match, and then he lost game 7. I think it was the first game he lost, if I remember correctly. And he had white going into the last round. And so he wanted just to sort of play safely and make a draw. And I told him, absolutely, under no circumstances should you play safely and make a draw. I said, like, that you should just go for it and just try to kill this guy. Like, you've got white, just try to beat him. And my role, actually, the coaching aspect, the psychological aspect turned out to be pretty important because I think I think I really did make a difference in helping him do that. And we had, as he was walking towards the game, I said, Vishy, I want you to beat him so bad that they're going to need to use dental records to identify him.
Yeah.
And he laughed. He said, okay, Pat. And as he walked off, I said, remember, Vishy, dental records. It became an inside joke between the two of us. And so what happened was Vishy won a very nice game. And I think that was important, right? Because the match itself was important for Vishy to prove to himself that he could beat Ivanchuk. And remember, at that time, there was a period of time when Ivanchuk was the number two in the. I mean, it was like Kasparov, Karpov, Ivanchuk, with Karpov sort of coming down and Ivanchuk coming up. And Anand was obviously very good, but had not yet sort of gotten to that level. So it was an important match for Vishy to know that he could play at that level. And I think it was also very important for him to be able to be free enough to take the risk simply to play for the win, even when a draw would secure the match, and then to have the confidence of seeing himself win against this rival that for him was a milestone. I think it was a positive thing. So it was, and I just really like Vishy, and we had a good friendship and worked together several times after that. And so it was just a very positive experience all around for both of us.
Yeah, and of course, game one, as you annotate in the journal, a very famous game. And to your credit, I think either in the journal or the book, you say this is going to be a famous game. Within the past year or two, Sagar Shah, when Vishy turned 50, he did a quiz with a lot of the top 15 players in the world where he showed some of Anand's most famous positions. I don't know if you caught any of this online, but there were some impressive, like he showed Magnus, and Magnus was able to identify almost every game, and different super GMs had different levels of identification. But one of the positions was the one from game one of where he was black against Ivanchuk and had these sort of revolutionary positional ideas.
Yeah. The whole, G takes F6, and then was in order to sort of do all these pawn levers to give himself this powerful pawn duo in the center. Yeah, I was very impressive. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see how that would leave a mark in terms of evaluating your chess goals.
Yeah, no, it really did, actually. Not to be too dramatic, but it was a life-altering experience for me because it was tremendous fun. And as I said, it was very positive. It was very successful. I grew from it, gained a friendship. I saw that Anand, I had a positive effect on him. It was just a wonderful experience all around. And at the same time, really clarified for me, okay, like I can have some goals in chess, but I also have to recognize my limitations and then sort of figure out what I want to do next based on sort of a recognition of that.
Yeah. And in that article, you also sort of talk about just sort of the financial, I don't know if you would go so far as to call them struggles, but at least the reality of, a young talented chess player trying to make it as a professional. Yeah. So certainly I'm sure how much did that weigh into your ultimate decision to de-emphasize chess?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that as absolutely the financial as well as the lifestyle. I mean, I'm married, happily married, two kids. And there was a period of I don't travel so much anymore. Maybe I'll travel. Well, at least none of us do now, but I may travel again at some point, but there was a period in my life, when I was traveling quite a lot, but traveling quite a lot meant, okay, I'm going to go, somewhere in the United States for several days, or maybe I'll go on a trip to Europe for a week, or, I do that several times a year. I would call that sort of normal business travel. Whereas of course for chess, if you're really ambitious and you're in your prime, like you might have to spend months on the road if you live in the United States. So the lifestyle aspect, but the financial aspect as well, it's very hard. It's hard enough just to make a decent living at chess. And I think, by the way, it's gotten better now with the internet, but I think it was a lot harder back in my day. The thing is, you have to think in terms of your lifetime, right? Like you might be able to make a decent living during your prime years, but if you do that during your prime years, let's say until your mid 40s, which back then seemed like impossibly long ago and a long future, and now I yearn for. And if you hit your late 40s, and you've got maybe sort of another 20 plus years where you want to be, you know, sort of earning and so on and so forth, and your chess abilities are declining. Look, it's like any sport, right? Like you have a career, you have sort of a prime that lasts a certain period of time, and then you have to sort of try to build something you can earn off, either make enough at that point or build something you can earn off from them. And I think in chess it's quite hard. And what happens for a lot of chess players is it becomes teaching, right? Yeah. Sort of the main thing. And that's a grind, especially since, like, for the most part, the money in teaching is not, you know, not, you're not teaching the budding young talents. You're teaching young kids and stuff like that. So it's sort of like half teaching chess, half babysitting. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just like, you've got to know that that's what you're, that's sort of the arc that you're looking at. So I think it's tough in chess. If you compare it to, if you compare it to something like tennis, for example, let's say you're not number one, or, you're not Federer or whatever. You're just sort of top 100 in the world. You'll make a decent living on the tennis circuit, but then you also will be able to make a perfectly good living and a good lifestyle at the tennis clubs, sort of teaching and being sort of the club professional and things like that. Well, something similar exists in chess, but just at a much lower level, and that lower level just makes it a hard career to embark on. But of course, when you're in your teens, it's hard to think like that, right? You're just thinking, right, I want to gain another 50 rating points and I want to win the next tournament.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it's gotten significantly better. I think it's approaching the level of a sort of retired tennis pro, I think, now for a lot of people, that just in my opinion. But your overall point is still quite strong. And actually, I had mentioned when I interviewed your friend, I Am Stuart Rachels, that you had similar perspective even in that documentary American Grandmaster. I don't know how old you were for that, but you spoke similarly about sort of evaluating chess as a career choice.
Documentary about the Kasparov match?
Yeah, the Kasparov Simul. Yeah.
That was fun. My observation is that things have gotten much better for online. And by the way, I think there's a lot of potential for chess because of computers and online, which I hope we'll get a chance to talk about later. But just sort of purely the ability to teach online, the lifestyle is much better. You're able to reach more people. I think that's right. Like, and you can carve out a perfectly decent lifestyle and living doing that.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I mean, when you're young and you're setting a career path, I mean, you're not going to have, like, especially here in the United States, where you've got to worry about fun stuff like health insurance. You're never going to have that. So
that was a big deal. Of course, now with the Affordable Care Act, for anybody who's listening outside the United States, like, the United States has joined the rest of the modern world, and pre-existing conditions can no longer prohibit you from being covered. But I had a leaky heart valve, which was diagnosed 1990 or something like that. And I eventually had my aortic valve replaced in, 6 and a half years ago, 2013, all went very well. So, I can't say I recommend heart surgery to anybody, but right, it all went fine. I have not ever had a problem having health insurance since I entered the workforce, but when I was a professional chess player, there were literally a couple of years when I did not have health insurance because I could not get health insurance. I mean, it's just insanity, right? Yeah. And, I mean, things like that actually do enter it.
Yeah. Well, bringing it back to the chess board experiences, you've told us a lot of the Vichy stories, but I have to hear a little perspective on the 95 match itself. I mean, in New York City, famous historic chess match, Anand being the young upstart taking on another god, Kasparov. So what was it like being part of that team?
Well, it was pretty intense. So we had spent several months in Spain. So we being Ubalava, who's a grandmaster, and not quite at the same level in terms of some of the other people on the team, but a good grandmaster and an excellent trainer and coach for Vichy, and they had a long relationship. And then Jonathan Spielman, Arthur Yusupov, and myself. So that was being able to work with Spielman and Yusupov was itself quite an honor. And we worked together for, I think, 3 months in Spain, did a lot of good work, and then sort of had a month or so in between, and then trooped off to New York and worked together in New York. I think we arrived like a week or so ahead of time at the World Trade Center, you know, so I forget whether it was Tower number one or number two, but... But yeah, we were at the World Trade Center. That's where the match was played. And it was quite an experience. And it was, Vichy, of course, at that point had plenty of professional experience and so forth, but had not had the world championship level experience, right? So it does bring a different level of pressure with it. And also, definitely have to tip my hat to Gary in terms of the chess preparation. The way that match was, the first 10 games were very even. The first 8 games were draws. There were some very interesting draws in there, and Vichy actually had the upper hand a few times. But then Vichy who drew first blood. He won the 9th game, a really nice classical Scheveningen. The knight or if we go bishop e2 and Gary went e6 and so forth, that we had prepared that specially. Vichy, by the way, had overlooked a clear win in game 3. So it was, so we had decent position in game 1, had a clear win in game 3 he didn't execute on. 5 and 7 didn't really go much of anywhere. And then game 9, he really got Gary. Then Gary came back in game 10, just blew him out of the water. In a prepared line in the open Ruy Lopez, which Vichy had prepared, but Gary's preparation was excellent. Then game 11 was like this critical game, not just in terms of the result, but also the psychology. So Gary played the Dragon Sicilian. And to my knowledge, Gary never played the Dragon Sicilian after this match. Maybe he played it somewhere, but I think this was like the one time he had prepared it specially. And he had clearly seen that Vichy's preparation for the Dragon had this hole in it where, and it was a line that Vichy and I had both been playing actually with some real success, but Gary had identified, actually this had been known for decades that Black had a way of equalizing, but it had sort of been lost to the sands of time, and Gary, resuscitated it and equalized out of the opening. But he didn't like completely equalize, and he offered Vichy a draw, and Vichy turned it down because he still had a slight edge, very slight, but still something to play for. And then there was just this terrible double blunder where in this relatively equal end game, but still Vichy had the slight advantage, Gary blundered a pawn. And it didn't require much to see it. And if Vichy had executed correctly, he would have had a pawn up end game, which I analyze in the book. And I think it was drawn with best play, but for sure gave some practical chances. And instead, Vichy blundered in return and allowed a basic combination, which Gary saw, and then that was the end of the game. And the result was kind of shattering for Vichy. He held a draw with Black in the next game, in game 12, in a tough opening, but fought very hard and held the draw. And then we had all sort of like done some work, and we sort of split the team up, and I don't mean to sort of ascribe whatever responsibility one way or the other. It's just the fact of the matter. Like, I was working on one line and the rest of the team was working on sort of the main line. And so I was sort of put to work on this auxiliary line with Castle's queenside instead of bishop c4 in the main line that Vichy never ended up playing. And so Vichy played this side line that they had decided like would be a way for him to try to get a small edge. He played the side line. and he didn't play it terribly well, and he got sort of, you know, it was equal, and then he was worse, and then he was much worse, and then it was over. And I think, like, that was just to lose with white in that way was just ugly. And then with black, he shook it up. At that point, he played the Scandinavian. We had prepared this. John and Spielman and I, in particular, had worked together to help prepare that for Vichy. E4, D5, E takes D5, Queen takes D5, right? Knight C3, Queen A5, that way. These days, they go Queen D6 more, but, you know, play Queen A5. And he actually got a slight edge with black fairly quickly out of the opening, but he burned a lot of time. And even though he had a slight edge, he burned a lot of time. And in time trouble, he lost his edge, and then the game fell apart, and then he lost. And so in the space of four games, like game 11, 12, 13, 14, he went from having a real edge that he could have pressed in game 11 to a loss, to a tough draw, a loss that was just really ugly. And then in game 14, he could have, again, he had real chances with black, but it just sort of, he just lost the thread and fell apart. And so it was really this very quick psychological unraveling, which I write about in the book. And to Vichy, and I did not know at the time whether Vichy was really going to be able to grow through that and come out of it. And I was coming to the end of my professional career. You know, I was already back at school. I was at Harvard. I took a semester off to do all this stuff. But, you know, once I finished writing the book and I played the U.S. Championship again and so forth, and I won. But, like, afterwards, I went back to school, and I was already sort of towards the end of my professional chess playing arc. And so I was in the book, and I knew that when I was writing the book. And so I didn't know whether Vichy was going to be able to grow through it. To his great credit, he really did. And it's quite interesting how it took him another dozen years before he finally was able to sort of consolidate the world championship title decisively, beat Kramnik, who himself had beaten Kasparov some years before that, right, in 2001, and then defend the title successfully several more times before, of course, finally losing to Carlsen. So he had a tremendously successful career and had the fortitude, which I was always very proud of him for, had the fortitude to grow through that very, very painful period, that compressed four games where he just really cracked and knew that he cracked and had to put himself back together afterwards.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing living history you're telling. Yeah. And we had a question from a supporter of the podcast, Jan Schmidt, that I think you mostly just answered. He said, does he think that Anand missed a real chance to dethrone Kasparov in 95, or did Anand simply make too many unforced errors, especially of a psychological nature, or was the time not yet ripe for him to be world championship?
Yeah.
To be world champion, sorry.
Seven, number two, probably number three. I think, you know, people always, it's interesting how there were stylistic matchups in chess. And I think Gary was always a tough opponent for Vichy. And, you know, I could speculate why, but I think just empirically, Gary was just always a tough opponent. Whereas Kramnik was not a tough opponent for Vichy. I mean, obviously a very good player, but not sort of a tough opponent in the same way. But Kramnik was a very tough opponent for Kasparov. And I think, like, in Gary's mind, you know, he somehow expected that Kramnik was going to be the one to beat him. But Gary never believed that Vichy was going to be the one to beat him. And he was right. And then Vichy beat Kramnik. So it's funny how full circle.
Yeah, yeah. And Kramnik, of course, somehow this had escaped my attention previously, but Kramnik was helping Kasparov with that match, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, huh. So tight knit at the top, even though there might be interpersonal personal dynamics where everyone's not best friends. I mean, they're still, it's such a small circle.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's very few people who can, when you're at that level, to find someone to work with. I mean, look, Arthur Yusupov and John Spielman are obviously great players. I mean, great players. And they had, I know, because I talked to him about it, they had the same experience with Vichy that I did, right? Of just like, oh my God, I'm in the presence of the mind of God, right? Well, if you're if you're God, you know, humans get tiring after a while.
Right.
Probably want to work with another God, and there's only a small handful of them. So, you know.
That's amazing. Okay. Well, yeah, it's awesome. I mean, I could hear you tell Vishy stories forever, but I want to hear about your own career as well, Patrick. So when you say you think about chess every day, which is nice to hear. What about, how often do you think about your career? Think about some game you played or like a highlight winning, whether it be the junior or the US championship. How often do you reflect on those achievements?
Some. I mean, it's, you know, I don't go around thinking about my best games every day. You know, I'd say it's there and I'm proud of it and I'm happy for it. But I tend to think forward as opposed to back. And so I'm more immersed in the chess that's happening today. That's what really sort of grabs me. But, you know, every so often I'll go through an old game that I played that I enjoyed playing. So I'm definitely.
Do you turn on an engine when you do that?
No, no. And actually, one of the great tragedies of my life is I had all my games and my analysis on an old machine that blew up, and I lost it. So I still have my shoebox, and I still have a lot of those games. But all the work that I put in while I was a professional, you know, annotating my own games, all the opening books that I built, all that stuff is lost, and it's just sad. But
yeah, it hurts just to hear it.
Yeah, it hurts to tell.
Well, speaking of engines, I want to hear more because you gave this amazing talk and not that long ago, actually, at St. Louis Chess Club about chess and AI. So that's what I'd like to ask you about. But first, Patrick, I'd like to take a break and hear from our friends at Chessable. Know your classics. Later in this interview, you'll hear Grandmaster Patrick Wolf talk about how he became a GM by studying the former world champions. There's lots of ways to study, but one of the most efficient ways to do so is on Chessable using their Move Trainer technology. It tests you and helps you assimilate the patterns. You can begin with inexpensive courses like Chess Immortals' Wilhelm Steinitz or Strategy Training Bobby Fischer. There's even a new course on his endgame play coming out by Magnus Carlsen himself. Whatever you choose to study in chess, chessable.com can help you out, and their Move Trainer technology can help you remember. And we're back. So, Patrick, you gave this talk at St. Louis Chess Club about chess and AI. And I mean, you're a brilliant guy, so maybe I shouldn't have been so surprised. But the level of knowledge about how chess computers work really impressed me. What's your background? Is that just out of personal interest, or did you prepare that talk? What's the story there?
Oh, thank you. I got fascinated by AI basically when AlphaZero appeared. Right. I mean, I knew about AlphaGo, and I understood from a, you know, sort of a general business and sort of general interest perspective that AI was a big deal and so forth. But I think, like many people, when I saw those AlphaZero games against Stockfish, it was just one of those moments. I said, all right, something's happening here. I need to understand what the hell is going on.
Right.
Like, what produced these games? And I was going to write a book on AI. I actually worked together with Chris Chabri for a month and a half. I read a number of books on AI. I must have written, I don't know, 20 pages of notes or something. I ended up giving a talk at a Goldman Sachs conference that I got, you know, about AlphaZero and whatever. You know, obviously the book never happened and so forth, but I learned a lot. It spurred me to do some other things that we'll see. I spent a while contemplating doing something in chess in terms of a chess business, and decided after a while not to focus on that and instead took it in a different direction. I'm working with a couple friends, and we'll see if it on an investing aspect, and we'll see. We've been doing this for 4 or 5 months, and we'll see where it goes. But the long story short is, yeah, I spent some time really teaching myself about AI, and in the Learn to Play Chess Like a Boss, right, the successor book to the Complete Idiot's Guide series, the one big new piece that I did for that book was I thoroughly updated the chapter on computers and chess, and I inserted an entire segment on AI and how AI works and how it works for chess and so on and so forth, because I think it's I think it's fascinating. I think it's important. So yeah.
So, yeah, it really is, and you do a really good job sort of explaining how the different programs work, the sort of more traditional engines as compared to the neural networks. So what do you think is next for these computers? Are they just going to keep getting stronger and stronger, or are they finally approaching a ceiling?
Well, I have no idea. It's interesting, you know, one of the things I discovered when I wrote the chapter on the learn to play chess like a boss, is that the chapter on computers and chess. It turns out that every decade, computers have gotten about 400 ELO points stronger. And I mean, it's really weird. Like, I don't know why that should be the case, but you can pretty much draw a line back, and you know, if we can just talk it through for a minute, this will make sense. So you remember David Levy? I remember, unfortunately, because I'm that old, but you probably know that David Levy played this match against a computer. He made this bet that no computer would be able to beat him after a certain period of time, and he was right, and he played this match. And you know, and I think sort of the best estimate, and I think he played that match, if memory serves me right, in 1978. And you know, I think like people estimated that the computer was probably 1900, 2000 level. It's pretty good actually for 1978, right? You know, that David Levy won, but the match wasn't a joke, right? Like, they were real games, but you know, David Levy won because he was an international master. All right, so that's 1978, right? So the before there was Deep Blue, there was Deep Thought, right? And Deep Thought, I remember Deep Thought playing in this Open tournament in 1988, I think, and losing a famous game to Walter Brown, but beating Alex Fishbein. And by the way, the game against, just apropos of nothing, but it's really funny, in the game against Alex Fishbein, it got down to a rook and bishop versus rook endgame, the computer having the rook and bishop. And at some, you could watch like the terminal, like what it thought of the position. And at some point, it saw like force mate. And when it saw force mate, it said search terminated on the screen. We thought it was a really funny like metaphor. But anyway, so like, you know, so Deep Thought in like the late 1980s, probably about 2400, roughly speaking. Well, Deep Blue comes along like, you know, roughly 10 years later, right, against Garry Kasparov. And I think people would generally agree that Kasparov didn't play his best in that match, and in the match he lost, I mean, right? And so probably, you know, probably a little bit weaker than Garry. But, you know, maybe at that point, the computer had sort of a 2750-ish rating by the end of the decade, probably 2800. Well, 10 years late, so that's like the end of the 1990s, right? So at the end of the 2000s, you know, by that time, computers are pretty decisively better than human beings, right? You've got like Hydra that like played this match against Michael Adams and crushed him six ways to Sunday, and all the, you know, the Fritz was beating Kramnik and stuff like that, right? You know, so by the end of last decade, probably sort of like 3200, and I think this decade, what we're seeing, I mean, probably already Stockfish is sort of like 3500, and then AlphaZero, I think they were estimating this a couple years ago, maybe AlphaZero is sort of like 3600. So weirdly, it does seem like computers have been getting roughly 400 ELO points stronger every decade. Now, does that have to stop? I guess eventually it has to stop.
You would think, yeah.
I don't know, though. I just don't know. And I don't know whether anybody knows. I mean, I don't know even know how you would try to extrapolate that. Like, but they're getting better. I don't think there's any reason to think that the AI algorithms have been maxed out. There's still a lot that you could feed into those. And the hardware keeps getting better. I don't know, man.
And I know you've mentioned you've got some opinions about how chess should be presented. And of course, I do feel like the chess world has made some strides. And I saw in my research, I saw you did a little quick hitter interview with Maurice Ashley about 6-7 years ago,
right?
When you were at the St. Louis Chess Club. And you actually mentioned that even back then you were saying that you felt like there was a paradigm shift coming in terms of how chess could be presented. So I was curious, has any of what you envisioned happened? And if not, or if so, like what do you think the future has in store?
Yeah, that interview was 5 years ago. I remember that at the in St. Louis. So I would say no. I don't think it's happened yet. And I think partly it hasn't happened because I think the computers aren't quite good enough. Partly it hasn't happened because it would require a concerted effort to do it. And I think the two logical companies to do this are either chess.com or chess24. And I'd be happy to talk with either one of them if they're interested. But here's what I think is the future. We are now close to the point, maybe not quite, but we'll get there soon, where basically a computer can look at a chess position and pretty much know what the best move is pretty quickly. Now, you know, it may change its views over, like, you know, if you give it a few minutes, it may change its views, so forth. But already, I think the computers are just so much better than the best humans in the world that you can pretty much take any chess position and feed it to, you know, Alpha Zero, whatnot, and it will just know in 30 seconds or a minute what should happen. And just whatever Magnus Carlsen or anybody else, you know, sort of thinks about for a long time, like you're just sort of approaching what the computer sees very quickly. And if we're not there yet, we'll be there very soon, right? When we get to that point, it then becomes possible to explain the game at a wholly different level. If you watch chess games now, the way they're presented, it basically looks like people are just trying to replicate the 1980s. Like basically it's Maurice Ashley and Yasser Seirawan or Peter Sfidler or someone like that. All great guys, all do this really well. But basically they're just sort of riffing at the top of their heads. Oh, maybe this is a good move. Oh, maybe this is a good move. And you know, I remember the time when this and that. And meanwhile, you're just waiting for the game to be played. You're just sort of like waiting for the next move to happen. So that the game remains a mystery that is being played out and will not be understood until the next day. Well, that's a very sort of 20th century way of thinking about a chess game, right? There's no reason why it needs to be like that. You could present a game in such a way that people know what the right moves are. And now you can go deeper, because now you can do not only what is the right move, but what is the likelihood of the player at the board finding the right move or playing each given move, and what is the likely outcome of the game. You see where I'm going with this? Where you, the spectator, can be engaged in the game through the help of the computer in a completely different way. Now it's not some mystery that's unfolding before you, but now you have knowledge about what could happen and should happen and is likely to happen, that you have this sort of privileged knowledge, and the people at the board are toiling away to just try to work their way up to be as close as possible to as good as what you already know is possible. Once you have that, not only can you follow the game in a wholly different way, you can also start to wager. You can start to bet, right? And so now you can be playing with other people following the game to wager on what's happening in this mystery that you already have sort of solved for you. And now you're sort of doing these higher order, like, oh, well, I think Magnus Carlsen is 70% likely to win this game, so I'm willing to bet $100 in order to get, you know, $130 back or something like that. And someone said, no, I think this or that. I mean, you can sort of play on top of the game in all sorts of ways enabled by the computer. Now, this would take a lot of work. This is what I spent some time trying to develop and decided after a while, you know, it's too hard and I had other things to work on. But I'm convinced that there is a real potential to gamify chess in this way. And the companies that should be doing it are either Chess24 or Chess.com, because they've got the data set to do it. They've got the user base. I think you could really do some exciting and interesting things with it. But it's going to take the vision. It's going to take a commitment to it. And also, it's possible we're not there yet. It may be that we're still sort of a few years away, but I don't think we're more than a few years away if we are. And I think it's quite possible we're there. I think it would just take dedicated programmers and some upfront investment. Like, I think it would require a Silicon Valley type startup structure to do it, but not a crazy amount. I think it's very doable. And I think if you did it, not only could you do it for chess, I think you could do it for other games. I think you could create a really fascinating new form of entertainment here.
Interesting. Yeah. And of course, live sports betting, everyone talks about its increased primacy. And I know they've got the real-time algorithms now. It's a lot of it here in the States comes down to the legality in different places.
It's all shifting in one direction. There's going to be, like, this is just happening more and more. I thought about this a lot during the 1990s. Like, why is chess have such a problem sort of reaching the same level as other sports? And I think that one of the reasons, I think that in some sense the fundamental reason is, I don't know, like, what's your favorite sport? What do you like?
I like the NBA and baseball.
Okay, there you go. So NBA, baseball. So you don't have, you can't shoot a free throw. You can't dunk the ball. You can't do what LeBron James or anybody else can do. You can't throw a fastball, hit a fastball the way they can do it in Major League Baseball, but you can appreciate it because you know what needs to happen. And you, if you're into it, you can know what the statistics are. So you can know what's likely to happen. You can do fantasy sports on top of that. You can bet on it. You have all of the ability to do it because your ability to anticipate and understand is in no way tied to your ability to play. And that's the problem with chess.
Ah, that's a good insight, yeah.
The problem with chess is that those abilities to do those things are so intimately tied to your ability to actually play. But what computers do is they allow us to sort of lift that out, right? And so it takes work. Like this isn't easy. Like, this would take concerted effort. But I am thoroughly, fundamentally convinced that this is now doable with computers. And someone someday is going to do this. And, you know, maybe in 4 or 5 years, I'll come back to it and I'll try to do it. I'd love to work with somebody if somebody's interested in, because I've thought about this a lot and I have some ideas about what it would take to make this happen, not just in terms of what needs to happen, but how you bring the resources together. I'm convinced that there's a real opportunity there, but it needs to happen, and hopefully eventually it will.
Well, I appreciate that you're willing to share the idea that you're not just hiding your intellectual property.
Well, I mean, anybody can have an idea. You have to actually make it happen. But I'd love to see it happen. Like I said, I'd love to work with someone if anyone's listening to this. I'd love to work with someone to make it happen because I think it's a real opportunity.
Okay, so if anyone wants to reach Patrick, I don't know if you'll share your info, but if not, they can go through me and I'll make sure that...
My email address is patrick@grandmastercap.com.
So okay.
You can repeat that. That's fine.
Great. Yeah, and I'll put that in the show notes as well. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, I do feel like they're like chess.com was just saying on Twitter the other day, there's one of these sites that ranks the most visited websites. They cracked the top 300 in the world. Wow. And their traffic has something like doubled during the coronavirus. So I do feel like the sites chess24 and chess.com are just getting better and better at presenting chess as a product. But I see what you're saying about how you could raise the level of engagement significantly. And obviously people love to bet. And that's something that my friend Greg Shahadi, like he's designing the fantasy. They are doing fantasy, especially on chess24 right now. And Greg's the one designing the pools. And I do think that helps. But as you say, that might be just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, I think there's just such tremendous potential. And if you look at the way computers are used to present chess, you can just see, like, it's decades behind. The presentation is decades behind what the technology enables, right? It's just waiting. The potential is waiting to be unlocked. And also, by the way, like, I have no idea how much better computers get at chess, but I'll stake everything the computers keep getting better at chess, right? Like, we know which way that curve is going. So you're hopping on board something that's trending in all the right ways.
That's a really good point. It'll be interesting to see. So when did this idea first occur to you? When did you start to think about it?
I think I really started. I mean, like I said, I've been thinking a lot about this since the 1990s. I mean, there was a time when I was sort of in the circle of people that Garry Kasparov had who were trying to professionalize chess. I mean, I remember the Grandmasters Association. I definitely remember the Professional Chess Association and all of that stuff. So I thought about it a lot, and the Intel was a sponsor of the World Championship match with on Kasparov Anand. They actually ended up producing like a 1 hour, I think, ESPN show, if I remember correctly. But again, like, this was all like basically trying to take like soccer and put it on and treat chess like soccer and put it on TV. It never worked. And so I thought about this stuff a lot during the 1990s, but I never had this thought, because, you know, computers weren't at that level. I think it was just being here in Silicon Valley, enmeshed in this world. I forget when, but like somehow over the subsequent 20 years, like these sort of wheels were turning. I had this thought when I was, you know, this interview with Maurice Ashley in St. Louis. And then like 2 years ago, it sort of like clicked. I was like, yeah, you know, I bet you could really do this. And like I said, I spent several months really sort of exploring it. So I think the potential's there. That's kind of how the evolution was for me.
Okay. And when you talk to your friends and colleagues around Silicon Valley and in the finance world, what is their perception of chess just generally and as a business entity?
Well, I think the general perception of chess, no big surprise, right, is like people think if you're really good at chess, you must be really smart. I don't try to disabuse people.
Right.
But, you know, that's sort of the general view. I think people think chess is really neat. There's a lot of interest, again, no surprise to you, a lot of interest in kids learning chess because, this, you know, it's prestigious. And you know, if my son or daughter learns to play chess well, it gives them a leg up in the world somehow. I don't know. But I think there's sort of that idea. So I think like chess has that very positive halo around it. And there's a lot of people who play chess and just like chess, you know? So I think there's definitely that. Certainly here in San Francisco and Silicon Valley, there's definitely, you know, as around New York, as around these various other places, there's plenty of people who play chess. I think as a business, you know that famous joke, a horse that can count to 10 is a remarkable horse, but not a remarkable mathematician.
I do not.
Yeah, well, it's the same sort of thing with chess, right? I mean, like, you know, if you create a business out of chess, like, you know, you've done something remarkable for chess, but not necessarily something remarkable for business. So, you know, I think like as a business, people are interested in chess as a game. Let me put it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there's a lot of potential, and I think there's a lot of, I think chess as sort of the example par excellence, but all these mind games, I think the computers and the internet are just so good for them. And I think we're still just scratching the surface of what we can do from an entertainment perspective. And, you know, chess has a, a very rich history, and it's a great game. It's, you know, as we all know. So there's a lot there.
Okay. And a sort of related question from a friend of the show who's actually been on the show. I am Kari Christensen, who is around your age. And he wrote in to say, he said, having Patrick as a guest brings me down memory lane as I met him in London 1986 in connection with the world championship match, Karpov versus Kasparov number 3. I believe he also played in some of the tournaments arranged alongside the match. We discussed and analyzed some interesting lines in the Nydorf. Some openings seemed to be of eternal interest.
Yeah.
And then he says his question is, considering your impressive career in the finance world, which of the skills, if any, that you developed as a chess player have helped you in your career?
You know, it's fun. So one way to answer this, and this will sound slightly snarky, but I think it's an important point to make, which is, if you want to get good at something, you should do that thing, right? So nobody thinks that the best way to become a great basketball player is first get really good at hockey and then use those transferable skills, right? Like the way to get really good at basketball is to play basketball, right? The way to get really good at, you know, music is to do music. So it's always funny to me to think that some people think like, oh, well, you got really good at chess, so that must mean you're really good at...
Right.
Right? I don't know. It doesn't really work that way. But somehow this is, I think, like what people think. Having said that, I do think that chess is good for training habits of mind and intellectual sort of frameworks. And I would say, for me, one of the most important things that I took from chess was sort of the internalization of rigorous feedback loops. I mean, the thing about chess, as we know, you know, that famous Lasker quote, right? You know, lies and hypocrisies don't survive. I mean, it's just true, right? Like, I could not begin to tell you how much bullshit there is in the world of finance, right? Like, and there's no end of it in the world of business. And frankly, in most of the world. But in chess, there is no BS, right? Like, not over the chessboard anyway. And to be enmeshed in that world and to almost sort of purify your ego through the experience of this rapid, honest, omnipresent feedback loop, where the only way to improve is to root out your errors, to search for truth, to search for excellence, and just sort of to constantly stretch yourself. I think that's a very positive thing. And I think you can learn that obviously anywhere, but I think chess is particularly good for it because it is so pure, right? Like, there's no referees, there's no dice, it's just all there over the board. So I took that from it. And I think clearly there is the marriage of the sort of rigorously logical with the kind of creative and fantasy that chess brings. Again, I think you can get that in a lot of places, but I think chess is very good for that.
Mm-hmm. And of course, it professionally, chess is part of the way that you became, like, you became friends with Peter Thiel in part due to chess, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's been some time since I've spoken with Peter, but we had a long business relationship. We met through just our common interest in chess way back in 1999 or 2000.
Yeah, so I guess it can open some doors professionally just in terms of the network you develop too, although there aren't that many Peter Thiels running around.
Yeah, no, that for sure is true. I mean, again, I think there's a lot of people who like chess. There's lots of people in the New York finance world. There's lots of people in the finance world generally, and then here in San Francisco and Silicon Valley in the technology world. I think, there are lots of things you can do to there are lots of networks to tap into, but chess certainly has its own and it's been good from that perspective.
Yeah. And you did one or two blindfold chess things at the famed Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger.
Actually,
15 of them? You did it 15 years straight? Wow.
I did 15 years. I think there was 1 year that I was slated to do it, but I couldn't go because my wife's father had passed away. So I had to go to his funeral. But other than that, from 1999 to 2004, and you know, you can read any one of Warren Buffett's letters to the shareholders back in those years. 1999 to 2014.
Okay.
15 years. You can, like I said, you can read the letters of the shareholder, and he says something to Patrick Wolf, he'll be playing all comers blindfold, so forth. So it morphed into a six-player simultaneous blindfold exhibition. My first year was 1999. My last year was 2014. I won most of my games. I probably lost out of six times 50. Well, six times 14, I should say, as opposed to 15. So let's call it 84 blindfold games. I probably lost, I don't know, four or five of them or something like that. My typical result would be sort of four wins and two draws, or, sort of four wins and a loss and a draw, or five wins and a draw, something like that. Again, some decent, some of them were beginner level, you know, maybe like sort of D players or C players, but some of them, you know, were A players or experts and masters. So it was pretty, that was fun. It was tiring. I remember every time I would finish, like I would just sort of like be bathed in sweat and I would be working very hard. And I finally stopped in 2014 because I wanted to stop before I went off the cliff.
Right.
I come 1 year and, you know, lose four games or something. And it's actually, obviously it wouldn't be fun for me, but it actually, I think, wouldn't be fun for the spectators either. Like, I think what's most fun for the spectators is if you win most of the games, but like lose or draw one or two of them, right? Because then they know that, like, oh, he's really good, but someone got him. Like, that's somehow like the best. And of course, from my perspective, winning all of them is the best outcome. But I don't think from anybody's perspective, my coming in and losing four or five of them would be a good outcome. And it gets hard as your fluid intelligence starts.
especially without chess being like, you know, it's not your primary location these days. So were you training for those matches? Would you try to ramp it up as the meeting approached?
No, not really. I mean, I'd had enough experience at that point that I felt confident I could just go in and do it.
Do you have any sort of blindfold tips you could give for people who kind of struggle visualizing the board?
Grandmaster Michael Wilder was the first one to tell me, because he had done like a blindfold exhibition. I asked him, this is like 1989, I think we were talking about it, and I asked him how hard it was. He said, if you just practice a little bit, it turns out not to be that bad. And I think these are grandmasters speaking to each other. So my guess is probably any grandmaster with a little bit of practice could play a number of games blindfolded. I can't honestly say that I did any particular training or anything like that. I would say it was just, I've got chess white noise going on in my brain.
Right.
For better or for worse, my neurons have been rewired to have like chess moves flowing through them. So it was just sort of like concentrating and practicing a bit. And I practiced with a fewer number of people before I went out to Omaha to do the six game exhibition.
And did you ever play Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger themselves? Or
I never played them chess. It's funny. I wrote a letter to Warren offering to come out and I offering to teach him chess when I published my book, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Chess. And in classic Warren Buffett sort of style, he wrote back to me and said, "Oh no, I'm too old to learn new tricks. Like, I know bridge is my game, but we'd love to have you come out and play." So he, as he does with everybody, he sort of roped me in to, be part of his menagerie. So I met Warren and we've corresponded a few times over the last some years, not just about various things, about business and so forth. But never actually played him a game of chess.
Okay. And what about any other sort of household names that you've come across in your life and played chess with?
Ken Rogoff is kind of a household name. He's obviously very good.
He doesn't count. Another grandmaster doesn't count.
also very, very good grandmaster in his day. gee, I don't know. I mean, obviously Peter Thiel. I don't know. I don't have good famous person chess game stories.
That's okay. That's okay. You've given plenty of good insight and stories. One other thing, Patrick, before we let you go, you also talked in one of the things I read, I believe it was your book, in the introduction to the book of the Kasparov Anand match, you talked about, you told the story of learning to play chess when you were a young boy, but then being introduced to my 60 memorable games at the age of 8. Yeah. And I recently, along with my friend Donnie Ariel, did a podcast talking about that book. So I just wanted to get your firsthand perspective of what it was like to come across that book. And if you have any other books that were equally formative for you, I'd love to hear you discuss them.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I don't think any other book was as formative as my 60 memorable games. I mean, I was given that book as an 8-year-old, they just were looking for something to give me, and they knew I liked to play chess. And I played through every game, in my room, over my chessboard, had them all memorized at some point. So, that book was deeply formative. It's because of that book that I'm a 1E4 player. For better or for worse, I really expanded. I played a nice game against Stewart in the 1992 U.S. Championship, actually, where I played d4 because I knew he was going to play the Queen's Gambit accepted, and I prepared a nice line and won that. So I'm Vivek Rao. I once played knight f3. So every so often I've deviated, but for the most part, I've been a religious e4 player. It's really because of Bobby. That book, I would say, first of all, the voice in that book is really engaging and honest and clear. I didn't know it at the time, but of course, is very much thanks to Larry Evans, right? Who edited that book pretty deeply. So I think actually I didn't understand what Bobby Vischer's voice really was until many years afterwards, which is good because there's a lot of unpleasant stuff in Bobby Vischer's sort of personality that kind of got filtered out. The book, the games were really interesting. The analysis was really deep. I mean, that when Vischer had this, was one of the things I think that's really interesting about that book. You can contrast it with someone like Kasparov, for example. Kasparov goes deep all the time, and that's great, and it's fascinating. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Gary, and I'm a huge fan of the books that he's written. But when you go deep all the time, it doesn't teach you when you should go deep. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In that book, in my 60 memorable games, there are moments where he goes very deep because it's necessary to understand what's happening and because it's the only way to tell the story. And then there's a lot of other times when he just goes deep enough. And I think that's there's a clarity to that that I think is not widely appreciated, but I think is pretty profound. So I think that's one thing about it I really like. He tells enough of the story of each game, and he tells it not just from the dry perspective of what happened, but oftentimes he'll say what he was thinking. This famous game against Trifunovic, where he's like, I almost played this, but it seemed like things were getting too quiet. And suddenly I realized he prepared a trap, that sort of thing.
Right.
And it's just really engaging. The game against Byrne, where the amazing game, right, where he goes knight takes f2, knight g4 check, and knight takes e3. And then instead of taking the rook on d1, he takes the knight on g2. And then he plays d4. And like, white's up a piece for a pawn, and it doesn't look like it should be that bad, but there's just, but the king is just naked. There's just no way to defend it. I mean, it's just an amazing game, right? Not only is the game amazing and the analysis is really fresh, But the way he tells the story is funny and engaging. Now, I don't know how much of that is Larry Evans, right? But, you know, like this, the famous, they thought in the analysis room that White was winning until he resigned, right?
Like, right, yeah.
It's just so captivating. Like, yeah, that book is really something special. And I think there are other amazing books that have been written that one can easily compare to that as being as worth reading and so forth. But there's nothing of quite that genre, that level of clarity and sort of somehow the right level of engagement with the games, deep when it should be, clear otherwise. Like, that book is really something special. So yeah, it had a profound impact on me, as so many other people. When I was younger, I read The Art of Attack in chess. That had a big impact on me. Pawn Structure Chess, the Hans Kmok book. I don't know if you pronounce his name right. Also Andy Soltis wrote a couple books I really liked. Also about pawn structure. Maybe his book was called Pawn Structure Chess.
Yeah, Soltis's book was called Pawn Structure.
Yeah, okay, Pawn Structure Chess. I forget what the Hans Kmok book is.
Pawn Power, I think.
Yeah. So, and then also Soltis wrote this book, The Art of Defense in Chess, which I thought was really nice. I always loved reading the books by the world champions. And actually, when I would teach people, one of the pieces of advice I would always give, and I continue to give this advice, the best books to read are the game collections by the world champions. Just, you know, whether it's Alekhine or Botvinnik or Tal, Fischer, of course, Kasparov, just given us like this incredible feast of books, like his modestly titled My Great Predecessors collection is an amazing series of books. My God, all these books are just incredible and so worth reading. When I was younger, I read the Tal book, really affected me deeply. I read Alekhine, I read Botvinnik, and then the Bronstein book on the 1953 Zurich Candidates Tournament. That was a big one. I read that one backwards and forwards. Great book. So all these books, so whether they're tournament books or game collections written by the truly great players, there's so many of them. And I think like that plus openings and end games will get you so far in chess.
You've got the true classical education.
Yeah. Well, we're lucky in chess. We have a tremendous literature as well.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
Yeah, I hope that people like Magnus, obviously it's great that we have so much more access to the thought processes of the top players, but I hope that they just write a physical book too. You know, I hope that it's not just like videos and stuff like that, because it is a great legacy.
It is a great legacy, yeah. I mean, of course, it is also true that computers allow us to, I think Chris on your podcast was talking about the sort of the Gambit app that allows him to.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, once again, there's so much that's possible with computers. I don't think it has to be books, because I think there's so much media that's possible. So not just sort of gamifying and providing the entertainment value, but also in terms of, obviously, ChessBase was just this phenomenal leap forward, right? And there's so much you can do there. So I'm a big fan of all that stuff. But yeah, I agree with you. I mean, the book is there, you know. The book doesn't go away just because you've got all this other stuff, and there are things that the book can do that nothing else can do. And so, yeah, I hope that Magnus writes a book eventually, and I'm glad that all of these grandmasters eventually seem to write books, because I think we're all better off for it.
Yeah. Okay. So Patrick, one more question if you're up for it. We've got one more from a Patreon supporter. This is from my friend Neil Bruce, who says he's a huge fan of your Complete Idiot's Guide to Chess. He thinks it's the best first chess book for a novice.
Thank you.
And he asks, have you thought about writing a new book for intermediate or advanced players?
No, I think the time for me to have done that would have been the late 90s. And that's very nice. Thank you. I put a lot of work into the Complete Idiot's Guide to Chess when I wrote that book in 1997. And I'm pretty proud of it. I think it is a good book. I mean, of course, there are plenty of good basic chess books, but I think that's a good one. And I think that would have been the time for me to try to write a book for the intermediate level, because I was really sort of into it then. But it was at a time in my life when, you know, I was writing my senior thesis. I was taking the LSAT, did not end up going to law school. I ended up, you know, going to consulting instead. And I was, had a full course load at Harvard to finish up. So I was, and during that time, I was writing The Complete Idiot's Guide to Chess. So I was a busy boy. And at that point, I didn't have the sort of the energy to do that. But I don't know, to be honest, I don't know whether I would have had anything to contribute. I mean, I wouldn't have, let me put it this way. I wouldn't want to write a book like intermediate level, you know, sort of like these books we were talking about, for example, that Andy Soltis wrote. I wouldn't wanted to write one of those unless I felt like I really had something to say. In many ways, you know, whether it's like sort of the art of attack in chess or pawn power in chess or sort of, you know, the pawn structure chess, I think in many ways these books are even more impressive because they're really interesting books by good grandmasters, right? Not world champions, but good grandmasters who really have something interesting to say. And I don't think I ever had that. I think what I did have was the articles I wrote for the American Chess Journal. I'm proud of those. And the book I wrote about the World Championship match, I'm proud of that. I had something to say. And, you know, it's not the most original thing. Like, you know, you're a second for world champion, and so you write a book about it. But I thought it was a good book, you know. And if I'd had something to say, I could have been motivated to do it. But at this point, maybe I'll find a way to help professionalize chess. And if anyone's interested, I'd be happy to talk to them about it. Like, I think that's the way that I could contribute to chess at this point. I think.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got some great ideas. So
another washed up grandmaster.
Great. Well, Patrick, was there anything else you were hoping to get in during this interview? This has been quite a treat.
Thank you. It's been quite a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. No, I'd love to follow up sometime in the future, but I think I'm glad you're doing this. I think this is a lot of fun. I certainly enjoy the podcast. I hope people enjoy this interview.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm sure they will. And yeah, it's a lot of fun for me too. So thanks so much. Again, we'll link to your book and your articles and your email address for anyone looking for that stuff. Also, your talk at St. Louis Chess Club, which I highly recommend. So yeah, a lot more that you guys can absorb from Patrick. But in the meanwhile, I really appreciate your sharing your experiences. Special thanks, as always, to my producer, Matthew Passy, and thanks to those who continue to help spread the word about Perpetual Chess. Positive reviews on podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts, glowing comments on YouTube help people discover the show, as does telling a friend or sharing it on social media. Speaking of which, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFishel1, or join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group and continue the conversation about the latest interview. Sometimes the guests even weigh into these discussions. The Perpetual Chess Instagram page is back in action, so lots of ways to stay engaged, as they say. But most of all, of course, I want to thank those who provide financial support to the show, especially right now with all this COVID craziness going on in the world. Most of all, I want to thank Chessable for sponsoring the show, and to everyone who kicks in via PayPal or the Perpetual Chess Patreon page. I also just put up a little donate directly link on the Perpetual Chess webpage where it says donate. But again, if you're not in a position to donate, I'm happy to have people listening and just enjoying the show. So without further ado, I'd like to give thanks to the people who helped make Perpetual Chess possible. I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities. Chessable.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Apprend Chess Twitch channel, Andrew Alhaji, Andrew Bach, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porteau, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Chess Central's Chess Blog, Chris Flanagan, Dan O'Hanlon, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Greg Harst, Greg Natel, Greg Shahadi, Guvin Manet, James Kennedy, Jens Green, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John Cromartie, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, Lucio Casada Silva, the law offices of Stuart Katz, LelaAnalysis.com for cloud-based Lela engine analysis, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the famous Mr. Dodgy, Peter Zodi, Reuven Fisher, Seattle Chess Club, Stephen Martinez, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of Strong Chess, Todd Kennedy, Wayne Beam, and I also would like to thank the following: Aaron Waffler, Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Andy Ryerson, FM Andre Terakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Anita Deer, Barry Hessian, Better Chess Training, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, Chad Hilton, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Shabri, Chris Lott, Christopher Wood. I am Christoph Zalecki, a.k.a. Chess Explain, Coach J's Chess Academy, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Bleskacek, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dalen Shelton, Dirk Decker, Drake Dominguez, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ethan Smith, Ian Mason, I am Elect, Donnie, Ariel, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letarte Lavoie, Frank Tortorice, MD, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Hans Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Jacob Kovac, Jack Perry, James Aspinwall, James Bonastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jadeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jim Ratliff, JJ Schnod, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, Jordan Goodwin, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, GM, Josh Friedel, IM Kari Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, IM Kostya Kovutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Reiforth, Laura Boyovsky, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Miguel Arispide, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigmat Mulajanov, Olaf Mueller-Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passan, and Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hallenbeck, Robert Turner, Roy Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott Doherty, Scott McKinnon, Sebastian Finsterwater, Shane Unger, Stefan Roller, WGM, Tatyev Abrahamian, Tim Brennan, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rotella, Tyrin Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Juniper, William Hogarth, William Peterson, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone. I will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.